Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, June 18th, 2021. Here are some of your headlines. Former Vice President Mike Pence heckled with calls of traitor at a conservative conference in Florida. Lingering effect of his role in Congress's certification of President Biden's Electoral College victory over former President Trump. President Biden marking a coronavirus vaccine milestone, 300 million shots administered in the U.S., and also pleading with those who have not yet gotten vaccinated to do so as soon as possible. He cites the danger posed by the new Delta variant. U.S. and Canada agreed to another extension of restrictions against non-essential travel between the countries yet another month. And today is the first observance of the newest federal holiday, Juneteenth, which marks the end of slavery in the U.S. in 1865. Voters in Iran choosing a new president today, but their enthusiasm may be tempered by a government council which disqualified many moderates from even making the ballot. From USA Today, former Vice President Mike Pence was met with boos and shouts of traitor on Friday as he spoke at a conservative conference about Republicans reclaiming the majority in Washington, D.C. Newspaper also writes that others continued to cheer, and those who tried to interrupt Pence's speech either were removed or left the event. It was the Faith and Freedom Coalition Conference in Orlando, Florida, and this is a bit of what it sounded like.
Well, hello, America. It is great to be back with so many patriots dedicated to faith and freedom and the road to the majority. And I want to thank my friend Ralph Reed for those overly generous words. I'm deeply humbled by them. And Ralph Reed knows me well enough to know the introduction I prefer is a little bit shorter. I'm a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican in that order, and I am honored to stand before you today.
Former Vice President Mike Pence. Back to the USA Today's story. They write, after 4 years serving under former President Donald Trump, Pence has faced backlash from Trump supporters angry that he didn't do more to prevent President Joe Biden's victory, though the vice president does not have power to overturn election results. And more from Mike Pence's speech as he talks about President Biden's just completed trip to Europe for the G7, NATO, and EU summits and that meeting with the Russian President Vladimir Putin. Mike Pence also talking about what the conservatives are calling the culture wars.
They rejoined the Paris Climate Accord, reopened the Iran nuclear deal. I mean, President Biden has been so busy accommodating the sensibilities of European leaders that this week at the G7, President Macron said how great it was to have a U.S. president back as part of the club. Well, the only club I want a U.S. president part of is labeled USA. But you know, President Biden's weak leadership abroad has had tragic consequences. Where our administration stood strong with Israel every single day, this administration all but abandoned our most cherished ally and set off the worst outbreak of violence in the Middle East in 7 years. They restored millions of dollars to the Palestinian Authority. They announced plans to reopen negotiations with Iran, and they remained silent as thousands of Hamas rockets rained down on the people of Israel. President Biden replaced strength with weakness, moral clarity with confusion, and loyalty with betrayal. If the world knows nothing else, let the world know this. America stands with Israel. And maybe one of the most troubling developments of the past few months has been the Biden administration's wholehearted embrace of the radical left's all-encompassing assault on American culture and values. Under the Biden administration, patriotic education has been replaced by political indoctrination. They abolished our 1776 commission and authorized teaching critical race theory in our schools. Instead of teaching all of our children to be proud of our country, critical race theory teaches children as young as kindergarten to be ashamed of their skin color. Critical race theory is racism, pure and simple. And it should be rejected by every American of every race.
Former Vice President Mike Pence in Orlando, Florida, at the Faith and Freedom Coalition Conference. Many speakers this year are considered candidates for the presidency in 2024. Former President Donald Trump making good on his promise today to endorse a primary challenger to one of his top Republican critics, Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. The former president threw his support behind Kelly Chewbacca, who is a former Alaska Commissioner of Administration, describing her as a staunch supporter of his agenda and writing, "Murkowski has to go." President Joe Biden hailing a coronavirus vaccine milestone in the U.S., but also saying there is more work to be done in the battle against the pandemic. Here's President Biden at the White House.
I'm pleased to announce that today we will have reached the mark of 300 million shots in arms in just 150 days. Let me say that again. 300 million shots in arms in under 150 days. That's an important milestone that just didn't happen on its own or by chance. Took the ingenuity of American scientists, the full capacity of American companies, and the whole of government response across federal, state, tribal, and local governments. Together, we built an unparalleled vaccination program and managed one of the biggest and most complicated logistical challenges in American history.
President Biden has set a goal of vaccinating 70% of American adults by the 4th of July with at least one dose. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says right now 65% of Americans are at least partially vaccinated. Analysis of CDC data by CNBC finds that will rise by July 4th to 67% at the current rate of vaccinations, just a few percentage points short of the goal. So vaccination rates would have to pick up in the next couple of weeks to reach that goal. President Biden again today urging those who have not gotten the vaccine to do so, and he cited the threat of the new COVID-19 Delta variant, which experts say is on its way to becoming the dominant strain in the United States.
Deaths and hospitalizations are drastically down in places where people are getting vaccinated. But unfortunately, cases and hospitalizations are not going down in many places in the lower vaccination rate states. They're actually going up in some places. A few days ago, we crossed 600,000. 600,000 Americans dead from COVID. More than every death in World War I, World War II, Vietnam and 9/11 combined. So even while we're making incredible progress, it remains a serious and deadly threat. And the data is clear. If you are unvaccinated, you're at risk of getting seriously ill or dying or spreading it. People getting seriously ill and being hospitalized due to COVID-19 are those who have not been fully vaccinated. The new variant will leave unvaccinated people even more vulnerable than they are a month ago. This is a serious concern, especially because of what experts are calling the Delta variant. It's a variant that is more easily transmissible, potentially deadlier, and particularly dangerous for young people. But the good news is we have the solution. The science and the data are clear. The best way to protect yourself against these variants are to get fully vaccinated. So please, please, if you have one shot, get the second shot as soon as you can so you're fully vaccinated. If you haven't gotten vaccinated yet, get vaccinated now. Now. Don't put it off.
President Biden at the White House. As he finished up his remarks, he was asked by reporters about whether that Delta variant could lead to a reversal of the reopening of the U.S. economy.
Mr. President, do you have any comment about the Catholic bishops?
I don't think so, because so many people have already been vaccinated. But with the Delta variant, can cause more people to die in areas where people have not been vaccinated. Where people have gotten the two shots, the Delta variant is highly unlikely to result in anything other than, I mean, it's the existing vaccines are very effective. So, no, it's not a lockdown, but some areas will be very hurt.
A new Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research poll finds that 46% of the unvaccinated in the U.S. say they will definitely not get the vaccine. Another 29% say they will probably not get the vaccine. Those who are most hesitant include white evangelicals, Republicans, rural Americans, young adults, and those without college degrees, again, according to the poll. That poll also finding many Americans are relaxing precautions taken during the COVID-19 pandemic and resuming everyday activities, even as some worry that the coronavirus-related restrictions were hastily lifted. Canada's Minister of Public Safety tweeting that the U.S. and Canada agreeing to extend coronavirus border restrictions for at least another month until July 21st. Closure to non-essential travel was first imposed between the countries in mid-March of 2020, has been renewed each month since. The Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau defending the action today.
Sir, I'm wondering if you can explain a little bit more why you chose to extend the border provisions for a full extra month. And why fully vaccinated travelers wouldn't be able to cross the land border more simply?
As we said, we are looking forward to getting back to normal as quickly as possible. But we're not out of this pandemic yet. We're still seeing cases across the country, and we want to get them down. At the same time, we also know we have to hit our targets of 75% vaccinated with the first dose, at least 20% vaccinated at the second dose before we can start loosening things up. Because even a fully vaccinated individual can pass on COVID-19 to someone who is not vaccinated. And that means we have to really make sure that not only people who are fully vaccinated can travel, but that the communities to which they will return are not at risk, because even though they are protected from hospitalization, the people around them might not be. That's why we are sticking with our principle of doing everything necessary to keep Canadians first, keep Canadians safe first and foremost, even as we move forward on loosening restrictions in a responsible way. That's what I talked with the premiers about last night. And I can tell you there is a tremendous focus on making sure we're working together to do this as quickly and safely as possible, because we all want to get back to normal, which means, yes, moving quickly, but it also means avoiding any further massive waves.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in a virtual news conference. He is in self-isolation following his international trip. About 70% of eligible Canadians have had at least one dose of the coronavirus vaccine. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average falling 533 points. NASDAQ down 130, S&P down 55. Some blaming the Dow's loss on remarks by St. Louis Federal Reserve President James Bullard, who said in a CNBC interview that he sees an initial interest rate increase by the Fed happening in late 2022 as inflation picks up faster than previous forecasts had anticipated. Washington Today continues in a minute. And welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. The UN Refugee Agency says that war, violence, persecution, human rights violations, and other factors caused nearly 3 million people to flee their homes last year, even though the COVID-19 crisis restricted movement worldwide. And the world's cumulative number of displaced people rising to 82.4 million. That's a post-World War II record. It's about the size of the population of Germany. Hong Kong's pro-democracy newspaper Apple Daily increased its print run more than fivefold to 500,000 copies as residents lined up Friday to buy the paper in a show of support for beleaguered press freedoms. This comes a day after police arrested five top editors and executives. In a rare move, the UN General Assembly condemning Myanmar's military coup and calling for an arms embargo against the country in a resolution that demonstrated widespread global opposition to the junta and demanding the restoration of the country's democratic transition. AP writes that supporters had hoped the 193-member UN General Assembly could approve the resolution unanimously by consensus, but Belarus called for a vote. And the measure was approved with 119 countries voting yes, Belarus voting no, and 36 countries abstaining, including the neighbors of Myanmar, China and India, along with Russia. And U.S. Catholic bishops overwhelmingly approving the drafting of a teaching document that many of them hope will rebuke Catholic politicians, including President Joe Biden, for receiving communion despite their support for abortion rights. The vote announced at the end of a three-day meeting of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops held virtually. President Biden asked about whether he might be banned from receiving communion. He said, quote, "That's a private matter, and I don't think that's going to happen." Today is the first Juneteenth national holiday in the United States following President Biden's signing of the bill into law on Thursday, creating the holiday. It marks June 19, 1865, when Union troops brought the word to slaves in Texas that they were free, 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas was presiding over the U.S. House when the bill passed this week, and she was interviewed by Russ Contreras, justice and race reporter at Axios.
And what do you hope that becomes of this day, that it doesn't turn into like our other holidays where you can get a good deal on a mattress or buy a new truck? How would you like Americans to reflect on Juneteenth, and what should they be reflecting on?
Well, you know, it'll be music to my ears when I'm hearing the Juneteenth holiday sale, or come out and get your sale of cars on the Juneteenth. That means we've really made it. But I truly believe here's what we can do with Juneteenth. We often hear of these other holidays that are so important. I'm always elevating our fallen on Memorial Day. But we understand America. It brings people together, first of all, as families, as communities. I want to see communities coming together on Juneteenth. I want to see those who are quite different celebrating the Juneteenth parade on Juneteenth coming together. I'd like them to be celebrating big events in their big convention centers or their big arenas. But I want to take this opportunity as well for it to be a somber time of reflection of a dastardly time in America's history. I want to be able to tell that little boy or girl that pulls your coattail and says, "What is Juneteenth?" I'd like you to be able to, as a dad or a mom, or as a family, as a church group or a religious organization, be able to say, "Here's the story." I'd like to see the reenacting of that period of General Granger so that people can understand the kinds of things that we have done in Texas or in Galveston, which will be done again this coming Saturday. I think we can do many things with this Juneteenth holiday. I think you will find in my heart, my spirit of hopefulness, that it is more unifying than you can ever imagine. And it is also the launching point for correcting the social ills, like improving our police community relationships, getting the voting system turned right side up, making sure we don't have that unfortunate situation of people being denied the right to vote. And what I've been working on for years with over 300 organizations, I think our Congress, our House can be a leader by voting on a commission established by the United States Congress to study slavery, to discuss, develop proposals for the disparities that are still going on today in the African-American community. When you study this, you will lift the lives of Native Americans and many other groups that had their tragic circumstance, but none held in bondage for so long.
Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee with Axios reporter Russ Contreras. An article at thehill.com reads, only six states, Texas, Massachusetts, New York, Virginia, Washington, and Oregon, have made Juneteenth an official state holiday, meaning state workers get a paid day off. That group is likely to grow in the coming years now that Congress has approved a paid holiday for federal workers, too. Only one state, South Dakota, does not recognize Juneteenth as either a state holiday or day of observance. And even there, legislators are pushing to add the holiday to the state's list of formally recognized celebrations. However, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem has declared today a holiday for state workers in honor of Juneteenth. She writes that she hopes state employees take the opportunity to enjoy the beautiful South Dakota weather on their day off. In signing the Juneteenth holiday legislation, President Biden spoke of other agenda items, as did Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, to help bridge the racial divide, voting rights, police reform among them, also economic reform. For some advocates, and Congresswoman Jackson Lee mentioned this, slavery reparations. Today, the chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, Cecilia Rouse, was questioned about this by Washington Post opinion writer Jonathan Capehart.
You've said about reparations in a Bloomberg interview back in March. You said, what's the right way to address it today is an open question. And so my question to you is H.R. 40, which is called the Commission to Study and Develop Reparation Proposals for African Americans Act, is that the right way to address it?
I still stand by the question. I still am not entirely convinced of what is the right way to address it. We know that this country has a history of slavery and discrimination, and that has embedded itself in structural inequalities that have to be addressed if we're really going to flourish as a country. There's no question about that. The right way to make up for that structural history and that racist history, I think it's not absolutely clear to me as an individual. I welcome any and all proposals to how to do it effectively and fairly. And most importantly, as an economist, I'm interested in what's really gonna move the needle. And so that we can finally close some of these gaps that have been so persistent and so stubbornly difficult to close.
So then it would seem to me then a commission to study and look at and come up with these plans and proposals is something that you and or the administration could get behind as sort of an official commission, no?
Well, I'm going to speak for myself. I'm an academic, and I believe in having groups of people come together and think of new ideas. So I want to speak for myself here. I believe the president is open to hearing ideas that are put on the table, but I don't want to put forward the official administration position. I know the president wants to address these inequalities, wants to do so in a way that really does move the needle, and I share that goal.
Cecilia Rouse chairs the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Conversation with Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post. You can find it in full at our website, cspan.org. Associated Press writing, Iranians voted Friday in a presidential election dominated by Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei's hardline protege after the disqualification of his strongest competition, fueling apathy that left some polling places largely deserted, despite pleas to support the Islamic Republic at the ballot box. We spoke about the Iranian election on Friday morning's Washington Journal with Trita Parsi from the Quincy Institute and Richard Goldberg from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
I think the most important thing right now is that there are very few candidates, and that even though the elections in Iran have never been free or fair, they've never been as narrow as they are this time around, in the sense that only conservative candidates were allowed to run, with the exception of two rather unknown or low-profile non-conservatives, in what appears to be a clear attempt at designing this election in such a way so that the outcome is clear from the outset, and that is for Ebrahim Raisi to be able to become the next president of Iran. He is the current head of the Iranian judiciary. It's a pretty an ultra-conservative with close family ties as well to the current supreme leader. And the rumor or the suspicion is that this is done in order to legitimize him and put him first in line to be able to take over as supreme leader once the current supreme leader, who's currently 82 years old, passes away.
Richard Goldberg, does it matter if they're having a presidential election when you have the supreme leader?
Well, it's never really been an election. It's always been a selection, as Trita talked about. But I think at least right now, the sham of it all is sort of being taken away by the supreme leader. It's as if he's felt that he doesn't need to have this fake process where it looks like there's an election, that you might have some mystery and mystique, that maybe there's the supposed moderate who's going to come out to be able to reform Iran. All that veneer is being stripped away to the fine print of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic. And I think this is part of the transition plan that the Supreme Leader has. The other sort of dangerous thing about this, of course, is the ability to legitimize a mass murder in Ebrahim Raisi. who has taken part in mass murders in 1988, the death commissions in Iran in 2009, helping sentence Green Movement protesters to death and to jail, his role as judiciary chief today in human rights abuses. So I think this is very dangerous for the world to be able to legitimize a massive human rights abuser, really a modern day Torquemada, and to potentially then negotiate with that person and offer him sanctions relief as part of going back into the Iran nuclear deal.
Trita Parsi, how would Ibrahim Raisi compare to outgoing President Hassan Rouhani?
I think there is a big difference between presidents, and they do absolutely matter. We can see that very clearly on the difference it was for the Obama administration negotiating with Saeed Jalili, who was the nuclear negotiator under Ahmadinejad, and the team that changed once Rouhani came into office and the negotiations were headed by Javad Zarif. It was a massive difference, and in many ways a key reason as to why the nuclear deal could come into existence in the first place. This is precisely why this is highly problematic if Iran now moves in a very negative authoritarian direction with the type of selection that is taking place right now. It's going to be very fascinating to see the degree to which the population decide to participate in the elections or not. The main issues in the election has actually not been necessarily the issues themselves, but whether to cast a vote or not. And it will be quite decisive if the participation rates go below 40 or 35% as early polls indicated that they would. If they go higher, however, there's also a likelihood, not necessarily a very large one, but a likelihood that this would have to go to the second round because Raisi would not be able to get 50% in the first round. And in the second round, things can change quite a lot. If the second candidate actually is Hemati, a technocrat, the former head of the Iranian Central Bank, who has tried to capture the anti-establishment vote, those who are voting precisely because they want to send a signal of rejection to Khamenei and the system as a whole.
Trita Parsi, Quincy Institute Executive Vice President, joined by Richard Goldberg, Senior Advisor at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, on the Washington Journal on C-SPAN Friday morning. More from the Associated Press article, there are more than 59 million eligible voters in Iran, a nation of over 80 million people. However, the state-linked Iranian Student Polling Agency has estimated a turnout will be just 44% in the election, which will be the lowest since the revolution. Thanks for being with us today on Washington Today. It's available as a podcast. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts. If you haven't yet, download the free C-SPAN Radio app. Hope you have a good evening and a good weekend.